Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to give you a really comprehensive but quick understanding of one of the most blistering critiques of modern economics out there.
It is. We're cutting through the noise to understand how the whole system is, well, structured to extract wealth rather than create it.
It sounds academic, but the stakes couldn't be more immediate for, you know, for everyone.
Absolutely. We're going deep into sources rooted in the work of economist Michael Hudson, but they're filtered through this really radical value-driven framework.
Right. And our mission is to unpack how this new economic royalty, the new robber barons, as the source calls them, has emerged, and what a blueprint for a regenerative alternative might actually look like.
Let's do it.
Okay, so let's unpack this and get our compass set first. Before we can diagnose the problem, we need to define the system we're analyzing. What is this rentier world?
So we have to start with rentier capitalism. Simply put, this is a system where wealth is primarily accumulated through, well, through charging tolls. Yeah, tolls on land you own, tolls on loans you issue, or tolls on monopoly privileges you've secured. It's unearned income. It comes from owning existing assets, not from, you know, productive labor or genuine innovation.
So you make money by owning the gate, not by actually building the road.
Precisely. Extraction over creation.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, for the framework that acts as the judge and jury for this system, the life value onto axiology, that is a mouthful. What's the core idea there?
The LVOA, yeah.
Mm.
It's our normative framework, our moral compass for judging what's economically sound. And it's all based on one thing, the primary axiom of value.
Which states?
Whatever enables life capacity across domains is of greater value than that which disables or diminishes it.
So if an economic activity increases life capacity, mm-hmm. you know, health, education, stable environment, it's valuable.
Right.
But if it diminishes it by creating huge debt or pollution,
yeah.
it's destructive no matter how much money it generates for the owners.
Exactly. We're judging the system not by its GDP, not by its stock market, but by its actual output in terms of provisioning life. Our deep dive today is about using that compass to explore a real blueprint for reclaiming the economy for the common good.
Let's start with the diagnosis then. We hear a lot about the neo-gilded age, a parallel to the era of the 19th century robber barons. The source material establishes this shift from industrial productivity to financial speculation. How does this new elite really differ from the old one?
The comparison is, it's key because it reveals a huge distinction between the robber barons then and the financial predators now.
Yeah.
Think of the Carnegies and Rockefellers. I mean, they were brutal monopolists. Yes, they accumulated wealth unequally, but they were also industrial titans. They were building the material infrastructure of the nation. Steel mills, railroads, oil plants, they organized capital to produce things.
So they were parasitic, but parasitic on a host that was at least actively growing and producing something.
Exactly. The contemporary elite, however, operates on top of a contracting real economy, their wealth explosion. It's fueled by financial abstraction, asset inflation, stock buybacks.
All the stuff that doesn't actually produce anything tangible.
Right. It doesn't require them to produce anything. They don't build a new hospital. They buy an existing hospital chain, strip its assets, load it with debt, and just charge higher fees.
So it's accumulation by extraction, not creation.
So that's the phrase the source uses, and it's perfect.
And this extraction is centralized in the sector we call FIRE.
Finance, insurance, and real estate.
And it seems to be the modern embodiment of this whole rentier regime. Why are these three areas so corrosive when they become these rentier platforms?
Because they've transformed essential public goods into sites of guaranteed debt extraction. I mean, think about the fundamental things you need to thrive. A safe home, education, and health.
The basics.
The home, the hospital, the university. They're no longer treated as social commons. They are now, and this is another great phrase from the source, platforms for asset speculation and compound indebtedness.
And this is where you, the listener, really feel the pinch. I mean, whether it's having to take on $100,000 in student debt for a required degree.
Or watching your neighborhood housing prices just double because of investor speculation.
Or facing insurmountable medical bills. It's everywhere.
The FIRE air sector operates by ensuring that every major milestone in a person's life, birth, education, buying a house, requires them to take on a loan or pay some kind of inflated fee. This triad is perfectly engineered to siphon income from productive workers and channel it straight into unearned rentier portfolios.
So the core pathology is
right.
Rewarding ownership without any contribution.
Yes. It's a system designed to extract wealth, not enhance the actual productive capacity of the nation.
And the key mechanism for this capture, for making sure all that money flows upward, is debt. I always thought debt was, a neutral contract, but the source argues it's a mode of systemic capture. How do we make that distinction clear?
We have to look at its function. When public goods are defunded and costs are shifted onto the individual, borrowing becomes mandatory. It's not optional.
Right. If you need a degree to get a job, student debt isn't a choice. It's a tariff you pay to even get into the labor market.
Exactly. And if you get sick, medical debt is just a tax on survival.
So this debt dependency creates this relentless upward flow of interest payments, pulling national income away from productive wages and reinvestment.
Absolutely. The money you earn working isn't going back into your community or into starting a business. It's going straight to servicing principal and interest held by the financial elite. Labor quickly becomes what the source calls a debtor servant. The productive class is working just to service the debt they had to take on to access the basics of life.
And meanwhile, to make sure this upward flow isn't impeded, the political system also has to be starved. The source calls this the collapse of fiscal democracy through strategic starvation of the public sector.
It's a brilliant but an insidious political strategy. You systematically reduce tax revenues, primarily for the wealthy and for corporations, to create this artificial scarcity narrative.
The government is broke.
Exactly. We're running deficits. This forces cuts to social spending, it increases regressive fees, and it leads to selling off public assets to cover deficits that were, engineered by the tax cuts in the first place.
And this creates the tax inversion that solidifies rentier dominance. It's a deliberate shift in who pays for the government.
Oh, absolutely. Look at the policy shifts. Over recent decades, we've seen major cuts or even elimination of capital gains taxes, inheritance taxes, corporate taxes.
The taxes that historically targeted rentier income and concentrated wealth.
Right. And at the same time, public revenue is increasingly derived from regressive sources, sales taxes, user fees, payroll taxes. This just disproportionately burdens the working and middle class who have to pay taxes on their labor and consumption.
The historical contrast is really stunning. I loved this detail from the source. In 1913, when the income tax was first implemented, only 2% of Americans paid it, and the structure ensured most of the burden fell on high-income, non-productive rentier income.
And today, the burden has overwhelmingly shifted to the wage earner. We are taxing the things that enable life labor and consumption while actively untaxing the things that are extracted from life passive rent income and speculative gains.
And this is where that LDOA lens just makes the failure so clear. It diagnoses the system as confusing money, just a medium of exchange, with true value, with what actually sustains life.
The system doesn't just make bad policy. The source says it has an ontological failure.
What does that mean in real terms?
It means the system fundamentally misdefines value. It treats $1 trillion generated by a speculative housing bubble as value, even if that bubble makes housing unaffordable for millions and diminishes their life capacity. It rewards financial activities that are literally anti-life by that LVOA axiom. The financial instruments have become the ends of the system, not the means of supporting life.
This brings us to a contemporary debate, tariffs. We hear so much about tariffs and protectionism as the cure-all for bringing jobs back.
Yeah.
But can protectionism alone possibly fix this rentier economy?
The source material is unequivocal here. No, it cannot. Not the way it's done today. We have to compare the historical function of tariffs versus their modern misappropriation.
Okay, walk us through the historical success first.
So in the 19th century, tariffs worked because they were part of a comprehensive development framework. The revenue they generated didn't just sit there. It funded massive public goods, it subsidized basic services like education and health, and it lowered the overall cost of living for the industrial worker.
That was the economy of high wages doctrine, right?
That's it. High wages and high productivity were possible because the state was lowering labor's overhead costs.
But wait, if tariffs just increase consumer costs, why do so many politicians still push them as a tool for reindustrialization today? Doesn't the source address the argument that they protect nascent industries?
It does, and that's where the fiscal shell game comes in. The modern tariff application, like those used under the last administration, didn't come with any of the structural reform needed to lower the cost of living.
So they just became a tax on consumers.
They acted as a fiscal shell game, replacing progressive income taxes with regressive consumer taxes. They became inflationary burdens without any of the accompanying public investment in infrastructure or education that would actually make domestic labor competitive.
So the core argument is that deindustrialization wasn't actually caused by high wages or foreign competition like we're always told.
That's the myth that hides the internal crisis. The real cause was the internal rentier system, that fire sector we just discussed, that inflated the cost of survival for U.S. labor.
Right.
I mean, think about it. A U.S. worker has to earn significantly more just to cover housing, healthcare, and debt, regardless of how efficient their factory is. This makes domestic production uncompetitive no matter what trade policy you use. Tariffs without structural reform are just inflationary burdens placed on a struggling consumer.
To make this systemic failure even clearer, let's use the conceptual flows from the source material. We can visualize these two diverging paths. First, the current neoliberal rentier flow, where we are now.
Right. Picture a four-step downward spiral. It starts with how money is created. Step one is private credit creation, dominated by commercial banks. They don't lend for productive activity, they lend against assets.
Which leads to step two.
Asset inflation. Speculative bubbles in housing, education, stocks. The price of essentials just goes up and up.
And that forces step three, debt extraction from labor. Workers have to take on loans to maintain a standard of living, making them debtor servants.
And the end result, step four, is disposable income depleted and rising inequality. The money flows up, labor is squeezed, and the real economy contracts. It's a closed loop where the financial sector is constantly feeding off the productive one.
Okay, a pretty grim picture. Now, contrast that with the four-step vision for the life-coherent regenerative flow. This is where the solution starts to take shape.
This flow reverses the logic entirely. It changes who controls capital creation. It begins with public credit creation, where sovereign money issued by the state finances investment based on life metrics and social needs, not speculative returns.
And that money is then channeled into?
Step two, investment in infrastructure and commons. Public housing, universal health systems, green energy transitions.
Which results in step three, a lower cost of living and higher real wages, because the basic needs of life are met affordably or even freely.
And that finally leads to step four, labor empowerment and reindustrialization, but a reindustrialization that's rooted in meaningful regenerative work.
The difference is profound. In the first flow, the profit motive dictates where money goes, no matter the social cost. In the second, life capacity dictates where money goes. The goal isn't just rebuilding factories, but rerooting the industrial economy in the soil of life focused on regenerative value.
Exactly. And this is the definition of regenerative sovereignty, reclaiming the collective capacity to provision life. The source argues we have to abandon the false binary of thinking only in terms of market versus state.
Right. It's not about public versus private.
It's about distinguishing between life-enabling systems and rent-extractive systems, regardless of who operates them.
So let's get concrete with the blueprint. If we want to move toward this life-coherent economy, the first step has to be fiscal. How do we shift to taxing rent, not life?
We have to systematically reverse that tax inversion we discussed. The fiscal strategy involves eliminating tax privileges for passive income and instituting targeted taxes on economic rents. That means hitting the three major rent categories.
Okay, starting with land rent.
We need land value taxation, or LVT. Unlike a property tax that punishes you for improving your home, LVT taxes the unimproved value of the land itself.
Which makes it uneconomical for speculators to just sit on empty, valuable urban land.
Exactly. It drives down housing prices and encourages productive use.
And what about addressing the monopoly rent that the tech giants and utilities extract?
For that, we need aggressive antitrust enforcement and utility deprivatization. We have to break up monopolies and regulate essential infrastructure as public commons to stop the massive pricing power that extracts monopoly rent from every consumer.
And finally, financial rent all that interest income.
We need public banking and regulated interest rates. Public banks can finance long-term, low-cost investments based on public need. That eliminates the parasitic role of private banks in controlling the money supply and maximizing interest extraction on necessary loans.
Speaking of credit, this brings us to a really radical proposal in the source, currency as a commons. This moves so far beyond our current debt-backed currency system.
This introduces the concept of Lifecoin, a proposed sovereign digital currency. This is, I think, the most fascinating part of the blueprint. It wouldn't be backed by gold or even by debt. It would be backed by the real provisioning of life goods.
How does that actually work? Can you give us a tangible example of how that value translates into currency?
Sure. Think of it this way. Instead of a central bank issuing currency by buying government debt, the National Investment Authority would issue currency directly when certain life-affirming outputs are verified.
Okay.
So if a public initiative successfully completes, say, 10,000 units of high-quality net-zero carbon public housing, that verifiable creation of life capacity safe shelter triggers the issuance of a corresponding amount of Lifecoin.
So monetary issuance is tied directly to verified material and ecological outcomes. If you deliver real health, real education, real housing, that is the currency backing.
Precisely. It aligns the incentive of monetary issuance with that primary axiom of value. It reorients the very purpose of money itself from being a mechanism for compounding private profit to a medium for facilitating collective provisioning.
And all of this needs a new mechanism for governance, right?
Yeah.
If we're tracking value beyond GDP, we need new bodies to do the tracking.
Yes, through what the source calls regenerative development councils, or RDCs. These would operate at multiple levels, municipal, regional, national, to guide these life-aligned public investments. They'd replace purely profit-driven metrics with metrics beyond GDP, like life capacity indexes, ecological restoration metrics, and measures of economic democracy. These are the tools that ensure accountability to the LVOA framework.
Before we wrap up, we have to connect this internal economic struggle to the global stage, because the source material expands the critique of rentier capitalism into a geopolitical reality, the rentier empire.
It does. Globally, the U.S. rentier model operates through what the source calls the four-tier rentier geopolitical cascade. This is how wealth is extracted internationally.
What are the four tiers?
It's using dollar hegemony and IMF conditions to enforce dependency, requiring structural adjustment programs to facilitate resource extraction, generating debt dependency and capital flight in developing nations, and finally, using sanction regimes for political destabilization when countries resist.
So is the internal extraction flow just scaled up to an international model? But the source material also notes that a resistance is emerging, the multipolar regeneration.
Absolutely. We're seeing states reclaim sovereign monetary systems for public investment. They're forming regional trade blocks for resource sovereignty and exploring strategies like debt jubilees to reset the economic slate. This global shift reflects a move away from the debt coercion of the rentier empire and towards systems based on mutual benefit and ecological coherence.
The source argues that the global system is collapsing under its own systemic incoherence because it fundamentally violates that life value axiom. Reclaiming political economy really means restoring its moral compass.
And that compass is critical because the authors argue the failure of the system is not accidental. It is by design to channel wealth upward. The solution calls for an ontological renewal where the state is no longer captured by the fire sector, but reoriented toward its foundational life obligations.
So if we accept the diagnosis that the economy is now extracting profit from illness, ignorance, and debt.
If the instruments of exchange have overtaken the ends of life support, then the crucial question for you, the listener, is this. What is the true cost to your own life capacity right now when the economy is designed to tax life and untax rent? This isn't just theory. It's a call to reclaim real value from financial abstraction.